Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the BRC Trade Podcast on the UK's trade with the EU and the rest of the world. My name is William Madison, and as ever, I'm joined by our trade expert, William Bain. William, how's it going?
Hi there, good. Yes, into summer now.
Yes, and also joined by the director of the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium, Aidan Connolly. Aidan, how are you?
Absolutely fantabulous. I get to go off on one of these holiday type things at the end of the week, so I'm absolutely over the moon.
That sounds lovely. So the UK-EU negotiations are officially on a bit of a break for the next fortnight, but there's still plenty happening behind the scenes. We'll pick up on that in this edition, along with the latest on the protocol of Ireland and Northern Ireland and other trade news. So, William, starting with you, are negotiations on a little bit of a staycation this fortnight, or what's really going on behind the scenes ahead of the crucial period in September and early October?
Well, both teams probably do need a break because there's been quite intense activity, not just on the main issues, but also some of the other aspects to the agreement. I mean, let's not forget, if there is an agreement, if you include the provisions and rules of origin within it, you know, you could be looking at a text that is heading, you know, north of 1,000 pages. So there is a lot that has to be done to work out the areas where both sides can agree and could effectively start to put together a combined text. And then you whittle down the areas of disagreement into you know, perhaps the 5 or 6 main ones. And fundamentally, in terms of the dynamics of the negotiations, there have been some changes. So, for example, on governance, the UK side is now saying that it's not going to hold to its starting position of saying there should be different procedures to deal with any disputes that arrive from the agreement in a whole range of different ways. They seem to be falling in with the EU's idea that there's one single house in which all of the disputes are dealt with. Now, that could have some practical issues, because if that does end up being the solution, it could mean that, you know, there are sanctions applied for breaches, let's say, in terms of the fisheries part, in terms of tariffs on goods, which of course are not affected by fisheries. So it does have some implications moving to this one house decides all approach on governance. But I think it was always likely that this would happen. The EU hates the format of the Swiss agreements, has to constantly renegotiate them, different processes involved with each. Didn't want to replicate that even in a like form with the UK free trade agreement. In terms of the key issues at stake, obviously there has to be a middle way found between the current EU fishing rights and zonal attachment, which is what the UK wants to offer. Possible that there could be a middle ground reached there. Difficult sell for the UK government with fishermen, particularly in Scotland. Difficult sell for Michel Barnier with some of the member states, particularly in Northern Europe. But give and take is foreseeable there. Around state aid, it really comes down to whether those in number 10 are keen to get an agreement for a range of reasons, economically, one to, as they would see it, try and put Brexit to bed. And also the issue of the union. I mean, let's not forget, support for Scottish independence is rising at the moment. The SNP are forecast to do very well in next May's Scottish Parliament elections. And not getting a trade deal, leaving in the hardest Brexits, is not likely to be an argument that is conducive to trying to keep the union together. So that is an important consideration here. The need to keep opinion on Scotland on board, and that would tend you towards a deal. That is the overwhelming consideration in the month of September. Then I think we will see concessions and agreements around state aid. No doubt it will be portrayed as a great triumph in Downing Street if they happen, with the European Court of Justice not involved. But the quid pro quo will be to put down in really voluminous detail the common principles and standards around state aid between the UK and the EU. And for that, I think we'll also need to find out what the UK sees as its state aid policy post the 1st of January, which we've had absolutely no clarity or indication of any type of detail on whatsoever. And that will need to come as part of this process. Why are all of these important? Because without a deal on fisheries and state aid, there will be no zero tariff deal. And without a zero tariff deal, prices of goods in GB stores will rise. So that's why this is just fundamental, and why, despite the fact that things might be smooth on the holiday surface in the next couple of weeks, in reality, there'll be a lot going on behind the scenes to try and get that agreement by the start of October.
So have there been any developments in terms of preparedness for the 1st of January?
Well, since we last spoke, there've been some extra briefings which have come out from both the European Commission and the UK government. In the UK government's case, supplementing the border operating model, the system of processes which is meant to get goods in and out of Great Britain. Details on Northern Ireland to come. So yes, we've seen some new guidance on things like VAT, which demonstrate that there is going to be a lot of new processes involved, be particularly onerous for online marketplaces, where from the 1st of January in Great Britain, the marketplaces will be responsible for the collection and accounting for any import VAT on behalf of those who sell on their platforms. So that's going to be quite a big change. We did find out that the UK doesn't plan to levy import VAT on the customs duties themselves, if there are any, in the event of a no deal outcome later this year. So that will be, I think, of some benefit to retailers who would have faced an even bigger administrative burden in accounting for that in the event of a no deal outcome. So there are lots of things, I would say, in terms of top line asks and messages, lots of things beginning to happen in the sort of middle ranking issues that retail companies are preparing for. But what we're now beginning to find is there is a sort of vast vacuum when it comes to some of the really granular detail. You know, which form do you use for which part of the customs processing? When do you put it in? What code numbers do you put on the form? When can we get access to some of these IT systems that would be essential to make this happen from the 1st of January or the 1st of July next year, depending on the process? And that is where we are encountering an absence of detail, and where that is going to have to be managed and worked through very quickly over the coming months.
So the EU-Vietnam trade agreement has come into force in the last day or so. Is this the last trade agreement which will apply to the UK before the end of the year? And as sort of a supplementary question to that, which sectors does it is it likely to affect most?
Very likely to be the last new EU FTA that will apply in the UK. This deal had quite a long gestation. It needed a big push over the line in the European Parliament to allow it to proceed to ratification. And as you say, UK companies have just 5 months to see the benefits of this before, of course, they will slip out of this agreement on the 1st of January. Nevertheless, it is really important in areas like clothing, footwear and textiles. It significantly adds to the trade preferences for people importing those products from Vietnam. And there is quite a large element of production there that finds its way into the EU and UK markets. So it will be very much welcomed by clothing and textiles and footwear retailers. In terms of continuity, the UK government is saying that they don't expect any break in continuity. they're confident they'll be able to take this agreement and try and roll over with the Vietnamese government. But we'll wait and see on that. There are around half of the trade agreements that have to be rolled over that still haven't been done. This adds to an extensive workload that includes Canada, Mexico, and Chile, to name but a few. In terms of what clothing and footwear retailers can do, they have a choice as to whether to continue with the benefits under the GSP, the General System of Preferences, or to operate under the preferences under this new agreement, whichever are the most advantageous. And what happens with the EU system certainly is that the GSP preferences run alongside any new FTA preferences for a two-year period. And we'll see whether the UK government decides to follow the same approach if it has a trade agreement with Vietnam that it can roll over by the 1st of January. So yes, this is good news. It is helping supply chains. It is helping the economy both in Vietnam and in Europe. And it is a sort of beacon of slight hope in a sea of protectionism at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So on US trade negotiations now, the Trade Secretary Liz Truss is heading stateside this week to ward off any potential tariffs on UK goods. How are negotiations going between both sides in terms of that?
Well, it looks like Liz Truss has two purposes for being in Washington this week. One is to try and say to the US Trade Representative and the Trump administration more widely, please don't look at putting more tariffs on UK goods, whiskey, those sorts of products before the end of the year. We know that the sort of dialogue between the EU and the US has been really cut off of ever more bellicose language coming from the White House in recent days about individual EU countries. So there is a job there to say that it's not in consumers' interests, it's not in the global economy's interest to be whacking on tariffs on big exported goods at this point in the economic cycle. The other thing, of course, she's there to do is to basically push the case a bit more to try and get the UK-US FTA nearer the line by the time of the election in November. It's interesting if you think about the way that the UK government does trade policy. I mean, DIT does not have exclusive competence here. You know, it's very clear that a lot of the geopolitical aspects of trade policy are being dealt with by Dominic Raab and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. It's clear that some other aspects of trade policy were being dealt with by DFID before the merger between the FCO and DFID this autumn. So in that sense, DIT is the trade deal delivery department. And so the success of Liz Truss's tenure will really, I think, be judged by you know, how close she gets to delivery on both the US deal, the New Zealand and Australia negotiations, and what happens around CPTPP. And there is, I think, a sense of growing uncertainty around, perhaps not Whitehall, but more Westminster, about whether, in that sense, you would need to put all your eggs in the UK-US FTA basket, or whether the US, if there was a change of administration in January, might actually look to rejoin CPTPP, the 11-strong trading bloc in Asia Pacific, which President Obama was very much a champion of the US being part of. What I would say is there is no shortcut here, because some of the issues which do make a UK-US FTA controversial in terms of public opinion are still there if you join CPTPP. So for example, in terms of food regulation, both deals would clearly be very skeptical about the precautionary approach on food regulation, which of course is what the UK will inherit on day one after the end of the transition period. So the cost-benefit analysis of trying to do a UK-US trade deal is a very similar one in terms of CPTPP accession as well. As I say, she's there to try and push things over the line, but clearly if there is a change of administration, which the polls are indicating in the States at the moment is the most likely outcome, that will extend the process in terms of the UK-US talks, because any new administration will first of all have a new trade representative, so Ambassador Lighthizer will go, and there will be new priorities that are different from those of the Trump administration. So this could be a very, very lengthy process indeed. And the talk that we had at the start of the year, that there would be a UK-US trade agreement in place by the end of the transition period, I think will be simply just talk. There is no prospect of that happening now.
So the WTO is still looking for an interim director general following Roberto Azevedo's departure. How is the race for the top job panning out, and what else is happening in Geneva at the moment?
Well, despite Dr. Fox, the former trade secretary, entering the race and being strongly supported by the UK government and being called one of the top candidates by the US administration.
Is he not the guy who did the top 40 countdown on commercial radio?
There are many Dr. Foxes with multiple expertise.
sorry, couldn't help it.
And what it looks like at the moment is that when the nomination rounds begin, some people think it could be in September. Others think it might be delayed, perhaps towards the end of the year. Perhaps if there is a change of administration, you know, the attitude of the US towards this process might be slightly different towards the end of 2020. I think most observers think it will come down to a race between Nigeria and Kenya, between Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, the former Nigerian economy and foreign minister, and Amina Mohamed, the candidate from Kenya, who has extensive experience in the multilateral arena. So really it comes down to, you know, who will be most acceptable to China, to the US and to the EU. Effectively, if you can be the most acceptable candidate with all three of those major blocs, you have the best candidate to be, to have the best chances to be elected. So it is hard to call. It really does look like one of those two. They each have their strengths. But it is important because the WTO is in crisis at the moment. It has not been able to appoint an interim head. This week we have the new multilateral temporary dispute resolution process, which was brokered by the EU and China and other key members of the WTO, but not the US and not the UK, coming into effect to allow some decisions to happen, given that the appellate body is in abeyance at the moment. And if there is a new boss at the WTO this year, it is a huge and unenviable task at a moment when protectionism is taking grip of some supply chains and in some parts of the world, and protectionist rhetoric is being used by politicians to try and win support. But it is really vital because we need a functioning WTO to give businesses the confidence to trade across the world, that there is a proper rules-based framework that they can trade under and will be enforced. That's critical for investment because it's only economic growth, which is led by trade and investment over the next few years, that's really going to begin to repair the damage that the COVID-19 pandemic has caused to trade and to the global economy.
So Aidan, we're turning to you now. There's been a lot of activity on the issue of the supermarket solution around the protocol. Can you explain to listeners what this is and how it's actually going to work?
Well, firstly, to say that we didn't call it the supermarket solution. It's what it seems that's what the government has been calling it, and the EU has been calling it. And basically, there is a problem here of keeping the people of Northern Ireland fed and clothed and used to the affordability and choice that they have now. And the reason being that we have never had these frictions before. I'm constantly talking, not only on this podcast, but on the media in Northern Ireland about how Northern Ireland consumers simply can't afford the price rises that will come. So this supermarket solution is one where there's a basic principle, and that basic principle is dead-end host. That means that the goods coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland would be going no further, and there would be an evidentiary burden to show that it would be going no further. But what we need from the EU is to give us a derogation to allow this mitigation to happen. What that means is that they have to understand that the goods will go no further. There has to be a bit of a trust in that process, but the UK government has to show technically how that would work. It would mean that there wouldn't be the need for the customs friction, and then if we can extrapolate that process and that principle out, it would mean that we would be able to look at removing things like SPS checks, perhaps export health certificates. An average export health certificate costs around £200 in Great Britain at the moment. If we don't get that removed, then you're talking about tens of thousands of pounds per lorry load. One lorry load that we looked at before Christmas had about 1,400 different products on it, and almost 500 of those, because it is a composite load, because it is a consolidated load, are products of animal origin, and that would have meant that they would need to have those export health certificates. And you got to remember in all of this, retail is a high volume, low profit margin industry. That means that even small cost rises can make a huge difference. And I'll go back to our guiding principle on all this, that if the new costs are higher than the profit margin, then either the product or the business model becomes unviable. And neither of those are good news for business, and neither of those are good news for the Northern Ireland consumer.
So sort of to that point, how price sensitive are Northern Ireland consumer goods to all of the new paperwork on goods coming through GB?
Well, if you, the goods themselves, like I said, the Northern Ireland retail industry, the same as the UK retail industry, it's high volume, low profit margin. That means that even a small increase can actually knock out the profitability. But we have always said that our Brexit campaign has been built around a fair deal for consumers, and that's especially important when you look at the Northern Ireland consumer. Northern Ireland average wages are the lowest of any region across the UK. Northern Ireland households have around half the discretionary income of Great British households. At the moment, it's about £119 per week discretionary income. That's the money that is left over when you pay all your big bills. And that's compared to about £215 per week discretionary income for the average household across Great Britain. Northern Ireland adults have the most unsecured debt of all of the UK regions. One in five of Northern Ireland adults are over indebted. That's again higher than any other UK region. 10% of NI adults are in difficulty financial. Another 29% of NI adults are surviving. Even though they have the lowest income, Northern Ireland household spend is one of the highest proportionally in the UK. Fuel costs and even car insurance is already higher for the Northern Ireland consumer. That sort of builds the picture of how little wiggle room, of how little ability there is for Northern Ireland consumers to absorb any of these costs. And that's a real factor in why we're working so hard and why we're talking to so many different influencers in this, the Commission, the UK government, the Irish government, and the Northern Ireland Executive, quite simply because this is something that matters to communities across Northern Ireland.
So there's a hard deadline on the 1st of January for the protocol issues to be up and running. How is that focusing the minds at the moment?
I think if you look in the business sphere, it's amazing the amount of stuff that's being talked about now that we've been talking about for about three years, even something as simple as the difference quality of pallets that are needed between a third country going into the EU and the EU to EU intra-trade. And I think there is a sort of worry within the business community that there is a lot to do in a very short in a very short amount of time. But there's also some positive signs. You know, we've been talking to the Commission, we've been talking to the government, and there seems to be a lot more technically intense talks going on. There seems to be a little more air of positivity than there has been. I think all of this is stemming from the fact that when the command paper came out, it was the first time that there was a realisation that there was a problem and the UK government was actually going to try and implement on the proposals and on under its responsibilities under the withdrawal agreement and the Northern Ireland Protocol. So, yeah, it's a bit of a mixed picture. We are worried as an industry. Business in, across Northern Ireland is worried because, you know, it's not the case of some people looking to get the final deal so they can just know what they're implementing. There's a lot of people who are looking here to see whether or not their business model continues to work because of the new frictions that will come into effect on the 1st of January. So that's quite worrying. But the fact that there is a level of negotiation and a level of technical engagement is a cause for positivity. We just wish it had happened 6 months ago.
So as we record this today, the death of peace activist, parliamentarian, and one of the key architects of the Good Friday Agreement, John Hume, has just been announced. Aidan, can you sum up what impact he has made?
I grew up in Northern Ireland during the 80s and the 90s, and I knew what it was like to grow up in an area that was at war with itself. John Hume was an architect of the peace that we hold so dear. He helped create the climate that brought an end to violence in Northern Ireland. Despite enormous criticism, he always defended his decision to talk to Sinn Féin in order to build that peace process. And his role was crucial. He once said that politics is the alternative to war. And that was his guiding principle, that we needed to talk, that we needed to move things forward by peaceful means. And I think, you know, his influence can't be overestimated. I think that the fact that we are where we are now, the peace is not perfect, but it's so much better than when I was growing up. It's a better future for my son, and you know we have to lay a lot of that at the feet of John Hume. He didn't do it on his own. There was a lot of other people who were involved in it, but I don't think that it would have happened if John Hume wasn't there. You know, he won the Nobel Prize, he won the Gandhi Peace Prize, he won the Martin Luther King Award, but I think the biggest prize that he won was the enduring and lasting peace that we have 22 years on from the Good Friday Agreement.
Absolutely, and I think on that very poignant point, we will leave the discussion for today. So it might be the heart of summer at the moment, but we'll keep you all in touch with key trade developments, and watch out later this week for our new Brexit Hub being launched on the BRC website. That's brc.org.uk, with all you need to know there. If you're having time off, enjoy it, and we'll see you again in a couple of weeks for the next edition. That's goodbye from us.